Asian structure of the new Cold War, where confrontations and crises take place on a daily basis, will be strengthened. Also, peace in Asia, the Pacific region, and the Korean Peninsula in Northeast Asia will be destroyed.
North Korea, meanwhile, launched a ballistic missile on the second day of the NATO summit. Tensions have been high, with the U.S. and South Korea holding large-scale military drills and planning to again soon deploy a U.S. nuclear submarine to South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Seventeen years have passed since Israel launched its biggest full-scale war against Lebanon, apart from the 1982 invasion. The Israeli Air Force bombarded the infrastructure of Lebanon, threw cluster munitions in most of southern Lebanon, and killed over 1,200 people. The town of Bint Jbeil witnessed some of the most fierce fighting during the 2006 war. This market was turned to rubble, yet that was a cost the people of Lebanon were ready to pay if it meant that Israel would be deterred from launching another act of aggression. The fighting here turned to hand-to-hand combat at times, and the Israelis were still incapable of dislodging Hezbollah, while resistance rockets increased. Strategy experts believe that before 2006, Hezbollah's main goal was a strategy of defense. Yet the fighting capabilities of the resistance has reached an extent where launching a preemptive war against the Israelis is plausible. Israel's internal investigations into the July war proved that it was a failed mission for the regime. Yet Hezbollah's military presence remains intact and its popular support stronger than ever before. The 2006 July war gave birth to a new equilibrium in the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and it proved that Hezbollah was not to be taken lightly. Israel's worst fear now is that any wrong move could find Hezbollah in the Galilee region. Maryam Saleh, Maruna Ras, South Lebanon.
The wheels of the British economy are turning, but not fast enough, and the state of the job market is one indicator. The UK's Office for National Statistics says the unemployment rate jumped to 4% into 3 months to May this year, up from 3.8% previously, driven by wage rises and by people out of work for up to 12 months.
Well, employment levels are high, but the trouble with Britain is we got less people working than pre-COVID. So we got record levels in employment. We're not far off the record levels, but the number of people in jobs has gone down because we've got this sort of 600,000 to 900,000 people seem to have disappeared from the workforce.
Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt has put getting Britons back into work at the heart of his plan for economic growth. Yet more than 1 million people are still unemployed. Let's see how the UK economy compares with other advanced economies. The Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, says year-on-year inflation in the group of seven wealthy nations fell to 4.6% in May this year, down from 5.4% in April, reaching its lowest level since September 2021, making the UK the only country in the G7 where inflation is at 8.7%.
Well, the cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it. But, of course, Britain has the additional problem of Brexit, and that has pushed up inflation costs across the economy. It's the only explanation for the big differential.
The Bank of England, whose job it is to control inflation, has responded with increasing the interest rate 13 times so far, with more interest rate rises on the horizon. That has seen mortgage rates soar, making repayments more difficult for homeowners, many of whom who have seen their salaries squeezed by inflation, setting off a tidal wave of public sector strikes over the past year. The government here has promised labor market reforms, including expanding free childcare next year, hoping to encourage more and more people to go back to work and fill in those hundreds of thousands of vacancies that it says are fueling inflation. But the fact remains that the rate of economic growth and inflation in the UK remain particularly bad compared to similar economies. Saeed Bourazef, London.
To protest last week's burning of the Holy Quran in Stockholm, the Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government has officially banned all Swedish imports into Yemen. This means the Yemeni market will no longer carry almost 500 Swedish brands. The desecration of the Quran has sparked Muslim outrage and condemnation against the Swedish government, who continue to insist the Sacrilegious Act is a part of freedom of speech.
It is a revolutionary Yemeni people who decided that Swedish products should be banned from Yemen. We also call on all neighboring countries and the Islamic world to take a decisive stand against this act of aggression against Islam. At the very least, Muslim nations should ban all Swedish products.
According to the Minister of Trade, the Sana'a government has put together an economic plan to boost the battered Yemeni economy and compensate for the products which have been banned. They believe this will help Yemen move towards self-sufficiency.
The ban on Swedish products only took place after much research and study on pragmatic solutions needed to replace the banned products. There are going to be many positive steps and decisions the government will take in order to increase and promote local production to stimulate the economy.
That has been involved in what they described as a war on Islam.
The banning of products from Sweden, Israel, the United States and the UK is an obligation on all Muslims worldwide. This is because of the hate and aggression these nations have toward Muslims and Islam. These are people who do not respect the religion of Allah. The banning of products from these nations is a positive step forward to teach them a lesson so that we can depend on ourselves and increase local production and industry.
The Ansar Allah-backed Yemeni government said it is funding plans and initiatives to revive Yemeni production. This is necessary in order to provide food security for millions of Yemenis who have suffered tremendously from food shortages caused by the 8 year of Saudi-imposed blockade on Yemen.
The fact is, although boycotting goods from nations that support insulting Islam has some impact, it is simply not enough. This is why the Sana'a government is calling for a united Islamic front to cut off all ties with Sweden and any nation involved in sacrilegious acts against Islam. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
In an unexpected move, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said European countries need to pave the way for Ankara's bid to join the EU in return for the Turkish parliament approving Sweden's accession to NATO. Erdogan made the comments at the airport before heading towards Lithuania to attend the bloc's summit. Ankara has been holding off its approval for Sweden's NATO membership along with Hungary, while all other members have already approved its accession. Hungary has signaled that it will follow Erdogan's lead should he give the green light for Sweden to join the military alliance.
I'm calling here for these countries that are making Turkey wait for the door of European Union for more than 50 years. First, come and open the way for Turkey at the European Union, and then we will open the way for Sweden, just as we did for Finland.
Turkey signed a customs union agreement with the European Union in 1995 and was officially recognized as a candidate on December 1999. However, its membership bid was stalled due to what the EU said were Ankara's democratic backsliding and its dispute with the bloc member Cyprus.
I think Turkey's accession to EU is unlikely to happen now, for the EU's mentality is the same. They need to change the way they see Turkey. EU will not accept a country with Islamic background to become an acting member in the bloc. The EU still sees Turkey as it was before, not as it has become now, a key player in all regional issues.
US President Joe Biden is set to meet with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the summit. Sources close to the White House say Biden is to persuade Erdogan by approving an F-16 deal between Washington and Ankara, should the latter give the green light to Sweden's membership. The coming 2 days will witness intense negotiations between Turkey and NATO member states, with many wondering if it would end with Turkey's accession to the EU. Probably not, but Ankara will definitely harvest gains. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Just after the Friday prayers at the National Mosque in Abuja, the demonstrators raised placards condemning the desecration of the Quran in Sweden. The protesters later marched on the streets, raising the Quran in solidarity with Muslims around the world. They later stopped for a rally and called on all Muslims and people with moral sense to condemn the deliberate act. The demonstrators have condemned in strong terms the sacrilege under the guise of freedom of expression. They said it is unacceptable to insult Muslims by desecration of the Holy Quran.
We are condemning this atrocity because this is trampling upon our right as Muslims. Attacking or burning the Holy Quran is as burning all the Muslims or even humanity in general, because you must respect what people respect. So we are condemning what happened in Sweden. By so doing, we are protesting so that such a thing should not happen elsewhere again.
The most significant part of the rally was the burning of the Swedish flag in condemnation of the provocative act. The demonstrators accused the Swedish government, the Europeans and the United States of complicity in the plot to insult and provoke Muslims around the world.
You don't fight ideology with a barbaric act. The affair is the growth of Islam. If you look at the global trend, recent survey shows that the most popular name in the world is Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I look at the trend of Islam and Muslims in Europe. Definitely they are worried, and they have every reason to be worried. But it is the era of Islam.
Sweden has an infamous history of Islamophobic acts, and over the years, Muslims have been the target of violence simply because of their religion there. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
In July 2014, Israeli forces waged an all-out war against the Gaza Strip that lasted for 50 days. During the course of the onslaught, Israeli forces killed some 2,200 people, including hundreds of innocent women and children. A further 11,000 were wounded. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians during the 2014 war were systematic and deliberate, with disproportionate and excessive force used against civilians. Rights groups demand that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice.
9 years ago, Israel waged an all-out war in Gaza and committed war crimes. Israel used a tactic of bombing buildings with civilians inside and also attacked United Nations shelters. We have documented the killings and injuring of Palestinian civilians and the mass destruction of civilian infrastructure. We call on international legal bodies, including the International Criminal Court, to investigate the Israeli crimes and to hold the perpetrators accountable.
The 2014 war also saw the bombardment of thousands of homes and the displacement of around 500,000 people. The Israeli regime has consistently failed to make any attempt to hold individuals at any level responsible for the war crimes and crimes against humanity.
I was injured and my 60-year-old son was killed. 3 of my cousins were also killed. My family, along with 10 other families, were hiding in the basement when it was hit by an Israeli rocket.
During the 2014 war, the Israeli regime displayed callous indifference, launching attacks on family homes in the densely populated coastal strip. This is while the United States and other Western countries provided billions of dollars worth of military aid to the Israeli regime during and after the 2014 onslaught on Gaza.
The Israeli regime has shown zero accountability for the crimes perpetrated by its troops due to the protection it enjoys from the international community, especially from the United States. These actions encourage Israel to commit more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Experts say that the Israeli regime has committed acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip since 2008. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
When it comes to Africa, Iran has made its interest in that continent very clear, especially this administration headed by Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi, finishing off his last leg of his African tour, which took him to Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. Iran's president has said that it is ready to transfer its technology and experience in various fields, like in the health sector, to these countries. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Iran has an interest in these African countries and evaluate President Raisi's diplomatic moves, which has taken him from one part of the world, like Latin America, all the way to places in Asia, like Indonesia. First, let me introduce our guest. Javier Amara is a journalist and geopolitical analyst who joins us from Oakland, California. And Shabir Rezvi joins us from London. He's a political analyst.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, gentlemen, to you both. Elias, I will start with you. Taking a look at Iran's president's visit to these three African nations, it was not too long ago where the Iranian foreign minister also went to Africa and visited Tanzania and Mali. And, of course, as the saying goes, it's better late than never where you have an Iranian president to have not visited Africa in the past 10 years, and now this has taken place. What do you attribute Iran's interest in Africa?
Well, Iran, first of all, thank you very much for having me. Iran has had a long history of relationship with Africa, going back to thousands of years. It's an ancient civilization, and Africa is the oldest continent, the origin of humanity. So I attribute this as a natural continuation of a long, dynamic civilizational linkage with Africa. And it's good that at this time, Iran is turning its focus to Africa, the most marginalized continent, the continent that has been suffering from onslaught of Western imperialism and neocolonialism. And in this regard, Iran has a great role to play in charting a new world, the multipolar order of justice and fairness. And I guess the win-win relationship is something that most African countries will welcome.
One of the things, Shabir Rezvi, obviously that opens the door when it comes to the relationship between Iran and African countries, which Iran's president has said is the economic portion of his focus, of which Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, has said, we want to make sure that the African market is aware that Iran is there to provide him with any of the needs in a variety of fields. Give us your reaction to that. But in particular, what's interesting about what Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, has said, that it is ready to actually transfer technology to these countries. Now, I'll say that to be interesting because Iran, under sanctions, has developed much of its own technology in order for it to be applicable in a variety of sectors. What do you think about it?
Hello, good evening. Thank you very much for your invitation. Look, like our other guest pointed out, the historical relationships between Iran and Africa go decades, centuries, a millennia, if you like. However, in the current circumstances, I think what's interesting to note is that not only Africa has been marginalized, but it has been carved out by the European nations over the last 100, 200 years. Some were sort of known as Francophile countries in West Africa and Central Africa, East Africa, British, the Germans, the Belgians, you name it, every tin pot country in Europe. had a sort of a stake in Africa, occupying great swathes of the nation, of the continent. Now, what is important in the current circumstances is that not only is Iran able to provide developments that have taken place in the last 43 years since the inception of the Islamic Revolution in the technology field, in medical, in nanotechnology, in stem cell research, in military hardware that Iran has been able to develop. But I think the key point is that the dynamics, the geopolitics, and the sort of current situation that is developing is that most of the countries in the southern hemisphere and the eastern part of the globe are realizing that depending on the West, relying on the West doesn't really help. And what has happened is that in the last year, 2 years, even more significantly, is that nations are getting together and abandoning the collective West, if you like. The global population, 87% of the global population lives in non-Western countries, and they have to be dependent on each other. As I said, it's not just the economic side of it, but also the cultural aspect. And I mean the cultural aspect, not in the social and aspect of it, but the political culture. The political culture of being independent, self-reliant, and being able to navigate one's own destiny. And I think that is also one of the key factors that Iran can enlighten the friends and other leaders in Africa, that it's better to be independent, it's better to stand on your own feet and to develop yourself rather than relying on Western interference. Because what happens under the guise of economy, the Western nations come and actually occupy those nations. It happened historically, if you like, through East India Company in India and throughout history over the last 200 years. So I think Iran's emphasis compared to the previous administrations is that they need to focus for Iran's own economic development and also the economic development of the oppressed nations.
All right, yeah, this theme about how the West is not paying off by relying on them is something that's recurring in statements made from various resources or analysts, such as our guest there from London, Elias Amara. What are we looking at in that terms? Why has that happened? Because as Iran's president has said, many African countries have actually been a victim of the colonial tendencies. We are well aware of that. That's not new news, that Africa has been exploited when it comes to its natural resources. But this relationship that Iran is after and has gone after enhancing with African countries basically supports the country's independence and at the same time, obviously, in line with Iran expanding its economy with them.
Yes, very much so. This resonates well with all African countries. As you've said, Western imperialism has deliberately and by design kept Africa underdeveloped for the past not only 100 years, 200 years, 500 years. Africa has suffered from 500 years of humiliation, of enslavement, genocide, and exploitation of its resources, and in return has got nothing from the West. And so Africa now is emerging. It's a rising continent. It's a continent of dynamic young population. Over 70% of its population is under the age of 35, so very, very young. It's sparsely populated with huge resources at its disposal. And, in this instance, the cooperation between Iran and Africa is a natural growth of solidarity, that Iran is now looking to Africa to expand trade, economic relationship with Africa is a natural outgrowth of that. The two, Africa is a vast continent. Iran has industrial development, manufacturing development, technological development that it can put at the disposal of many African nations. And this kind of win-win cooperation is what is needed, away from the exploitative, imperialistic, relationship of arrogance, of imposing diktats on many African countries, of imposing so-called democracy and human rights, which are really the antithesis of democracy and human rights. Both Iran and many African countries have been at the receiving end. And so they're natural partners, and it is only natural that Iran is now looking towards Africa, towards Latin America. Many African progressives were encouraged by the recent visit of President Raisi to Latin American countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, because these countries have been facing the onslaught of so-called sanctions. I call them baby killer sanctions, actually, in order not to sanitize them, but call them by their name. These sanctions are illegal. They're against international law. They're against the UN Charter. United Nations General Assembly has passed several resolutions condemning this unilateral economic coercive measures. Recently, the UN Human Rights Commission also passed resolutions condemning them. The African Union condemned the American baby killer sanctions on three African countries, my homeland, Eritrea, South Sudan, and Zimbabwe, which President Raisi recently visited. That was his last leg, I believe, of his visit to Africa.
Indeed. So let's talk about the sanctions a little bit, because there was quite a bit of talk. Quite a bit of talk on that, Shabir Rizvi. I guess let me refer to what the president has said in this case in point. Zimbabwe would be a good one. He has said, the president, it is critically important that we, the victims of Western sanctions, are talking to each other, that we show them that we're united. And I'm happy that you have come in address to Raisi to show solidarity. Why is that solidarity so important in the face of U.S. sanctions, bilateral ones, and also any other ones that really are not only unjustified, but as our guest there referred to them, as killer sanctions?
Well, indeed. Of course, look, you know, many countries on this planet are being sanctioned willy-nilly. Really, sanctions have been used as a weapon of choice by the collective West, whether it's in the sort of current Ukraine-Russia situation that Russia has been sanctioned extraordinarily at a high level. Russia has had more sanctions applied than even Iran, if you like, as far as the numbers go. But the reality is that sanctions are used to disable countries. And Iran actually has been able to show that even under the most severest form of sanctions for the last 43 years, it has survived, prospered, and continue to progress. So the issue of sanctions is that nations which have been are vulnerable to sanctions by the West need to obviously cooperate together, work together, and collaborate, because at the end of the day, there have to be alternative ways of transacting business, and nations are working together. I mean, you know, in August, there's a meeting of the BRICS nations scheduled in South Africa. That would be obviously an interesting sort of point whereby I suspect other nations together will be also deciding how to get around the sanctions. One other thing which is important to sort of course understand is that the issue of dollar as a sort of reserve currency has been very significant in most of the African nations to do their trade. As I said, 14 of the West African countries are part of the Francophile nations, which have been controlled by France for many, many years. The other nations have also sort of had to rely on the dollar, but there's obviously debate of sort of having alternative international modes of transactions, which I think this sort of collaboration between Iran and other African nations would sort of assist and facilitate. One other point that I think has to be remembered is that since the advent of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has actually been working quite a lot, perhaps not at a high profile that President Raisi visiting Africa. There's an organization organization or foundation in Iran called Jahasa Zindagi, which has been working in Africa for many, many years. Whenever I visit any of the African countries, you know, the people are really quite proud that Iran has helped them in sort of, you know, countryside with agriculture, with sort of water facilitation, with sort of electricity. So Jahasa Zindagi has been an organization which has worked in Ghana, Sierra Leone, Kenya, Tanzania, okay, in many of the African countries for the last 43 years. So there is that goodwill as well towards Iran, not just sort of standing up to the Western diktat, but in reality, Iran has been actually working continuously to support and to progress Africa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a good thing that you mentioned that, because that shows, obviously, the intent that Iran has, when you mentioned Elias on more than one occasion, a win-win situation. It shows the sincerity from Iran's part in terms of not just watching out for its own interests, but rather that it wants to help in whatever areas that are applicable and that Iran can. When it comes to the relationship that is now forming at a higher level between Iran and the African nations, isn't it very obvious that with the West, these nations in Africa did not reap the rewards that they were supposed to? Because many always ask this question, why is it that Africa has the resources, but it's not reaping the rewards? I mean, well, what use would then the West serve in this case when Iran, for example, rich in resources, along with Africa, rich in resources, would have a need for the West in terms of their any type of influence in that equation?
Well, that's the raison d'etre of imperialism. It exists by exploiting. Imperialism does not believe on a win-win engagement with the rest of the world, with the, as my colleague from London said, with the 90% majority population of the world. It believes in keeping everything for itself in a zero-sum game mentality, and nothing for and this is unacceptable. This kind of engagement of this unipolar hegemony, its days are over. And, you know, it's about time that global South countries, South-to-South relationship, as Iran is doing with Africa, is welcome. And it's that is where we are now. We can evade the era of sanctions, of economic warfares, unjust wars, and through cooperation, through win-win trade, exchange of technology, exchange of you know, goods and services, create another world, another just world, a world based on fairness, on respect, on dignity of humanity, and the real human rights. Actually, human rights, as defined by UN Charter, is based on these principles, not on what the West narrowly defines as human rights, which is the liberal civil liberties. That political angle is only a very narrow, maybe 5% of what real human rights is. Human rights, as defined by UN Charter and as defended by Iran recently, for example, in the Human Rights Council, when my country, Eritrea, was attacked by Western countries with the human rights stick, said the politicization of human rights is unacceptable. The weaponization of human rights and democracy as defined by the West in its very narrow terms is unacceptable. We have to look at human rights in a way of fairness, of justice, of human development, of free trade based on win-win relationships. And this kind of approach that Iran is engaged now with Africa is very much welcome to Africa. It's music to African ears. Just as Iran is looking to the East, Africa is also looking away from the West to other partners, be it China, Russia, the BRICS countries, the Shanghai Cooperation, which recently Iran has joined. Hopefully Iran will join BRICS very soon. I believe Iran will attend the BRICS summit in South Africa this in a month's time. And the BRICS nations are now talking about a new currency, gold-based currency. Well, that's the de-dollarization that our colleague has been mentioning. Why has been the U.S. hegemon, the unilateral hegemon, imposing economic warfare, the killer sanctions on over 40 countries in the world? Because it uses the dollar as a weapon. Recently, a U.S. senator said when he heard that Brazil and China would be trading away from the dollar with their own currencies, he said, my God, how are we going to sanction them? He sure. blurted out the truth that indeed. They use the dollar to wage economic warfare on the rest of the world population.
Okay.
I think the world is sick and tired of this and is looking for a new beginning, a just multipolar world order.
And
Iran
is
comes here and has a great contribution to make.
Right.
Iran has stood up against Western arrogance, has stood up against sanctions, and it has not collapsed. It has emerged stronger and resilient. And this, to Africa, is the good welcome solidarity.
Thank you for that. I can't say anything else but that. But obviously, that's a biased statement coming from me. But you perhaps can answer that better, Shabir Rezvi. When our guest there talks about Iran in that respect, when it comes to African countries, give us why you think that's true or not. But it seems like that is the what's gravitating countries together is this move away from the U.S. in particular, the de-dollarization factor that our guest there talked about. And perhaps that's a uniting factor which would allow trade to happen between countries freely, whether it's in their own currencies, whether it's through maybe the upcoming new currency that the BRICS nations are going to hopefully announce in their upcoming meeting, or just in their own national currencies. But this uniting factor, is that enough to stand up against the West, something that Iran is preaching?
Well, look, that indeed is an uniting factor. But I think the situation is somewhat different than even sort of 10 years ago. But if you look at it in the last 50 odd years, that African leaders who did stand up to the West, like Lumumba, or like, Ghanan, leader of Ghana, either there was a coup at that time or they were killed. But now capacity has built and then nations have actually decided individually that their destiny has been sort of hijacked, if you like, by depending on the West. So this convergence that is taking place of the exploited nations, of the nations okay. that were opposed, that the nations that lost their dignity. And as I said in my opening comment, is that Iran has actually provided the infrastructure and the platform for nations to stand up and be counted as dignified
thank
and
you.
Sovereign nations. And I think that's the key factor.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you to you both. Elias Amara, journalist and geopolitical analyst from Oakland, California. A pleasure. And Shabir Rezvi, thank you, political analyst from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahweh and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran,
You're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
The imposition of Western sanctions against countries such as Russia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and China has caused these countries to improve their relations with developing countries and create a multipolar world order by abandoning or reducing the role of the US dollar in their commercial transactions. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia's Sputnik News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. President Vladimir Putin said the emerging multipolar world order is strengthening, and Russia's adversaries have failed utterly in their quest to isolate the country from international trade and destroy Russia's economy. President Putin said in a plenary address to the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum on Friday, 16th of June, he said, "Objective market laws work stronger than the current political conjecture. This means that the neo-colonial international system, which is ugly in its very essence, has ceased to exist, while the multipolar world order is getting ever stronger." President Putin said, "This is an inevitable process." President Putin recalled that in the aftermath of last year's expansion of the Ukrainian crisis, Russia, facing sanctions and more trade restrictions by the West, expanded contracts with developing countries. President Putin emphasized sanctions and other pressures did not push Russia into altering its economic development strategy of openness to world trade. He said, "Notwithstanding all the difficulties of the past year, we did not turn to the path of self-isolation. On the contrary, we have expanded contacts with reliable, responsible partners in countries and regions which today act as the locomotives, the drivers of the global economy." The Russian president added, "In expanding trade with Russia by double digits or even multifold in some cases, the leaders of these countries demonstrated that they do not give in to external pressures and are guided by their national interests." President Putin said, "Amid Western attempts to restrict Russian trade using international banking system and major currency instruments, Moscow has developed new mechanisms for trade, reporting that 90% of trade inside the Eurasian Economic Union takes place using the Russian rubles, and 80% of trade with China is conducted in Russian rubles and Chinese yuan." President Putin said, "I have already said, and I would like to repeat again, the changes taking place in the world today carry a crucial, deep and irreversible character. This is what is important. In these conditions, it is necessary to move only forward. That means we need a proactive economic policy which can be built and implemented in also conjunction with representatives of the business community and with our entrepreneurs." The TASS news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Russian President Vladimir Putin recalled that in 2022 alone, after foreign companies began to leave the Russian market en masse, buckling under the pressure of foreign political elites, Russian companies filed some 90,000 applications for new trademarks, including for clothes, footwear, software, household chemicals, cosmetics, etc. He noted that many of the goods that were produced by foreign companies were being made in Russia anyway, and that when these companies left, they were simply replaced with the same products marketed under new brands by Russian companies. President Putin also touched on the issue of technological sovereignty, saying that the desire to maximize the potential of local industry does not mean production of absolutely all goods and services, but only those goods related to important directions in the economy. Elsewhere, he said, new logistical chains need to be formed. President Vladimir Putin said, for effective development is not enough to automatize individual production processes. It's necessary to act on the scale of entire markets. Successful examples of such working platforms already exist in Russia. They include the Yandex taxi market, the system of automatic credit by Sberbank, and the Ozone Internet magazine. President Putin also called for a mass implementation of autonomous technologies, citing the example of self-driving vehicles. As for the Western countries' decision to freeze the assets of Russian tycoons and companies abroad, President Putin compared such action to medieval robbery of centuries past. He said, many of our businessmen were surprised to find their accounts and assets frozen in the West. It never occurred to them before that this was possible. Brigandage in violation of all the norms of Russian and international legislation. They just closed them, took them away, and aren't even explaining why. This is like something out of the Middle Ages. The website of Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. Russian President Vladimir Putin has stated the growing use of national currencies for cross-border exchanges signals the end of the hegemony of the US dollar. Speaking at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, President Putin said the present trend of using local currency for cross-border trade, including in the energy sector, indicates the demise of the US dollar. President Putin pointed out that the dollar reserves held by the world's major economies were rapidly getting smaller, as are trade settlements using the US currency, while many nations are pitching projects to create new reserve currencies. President Putin insisted that Russia has never had any intentions to de-dollarize neither its domestic economy nor the global economy. However, he pointed out, due to American sanctions policy against Russia after the Ukraine crisis, Moscow was forced to ditch the greenback for other currencies to keep its economy running. President Putin explained to the audience at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, he said, "We have nothing to do with it. They are doing everything with their own hands. By pursuing short-term opportunistic political goals, they undermine their power, including in world finance. Because by using the dollar as a war tool, and there is no other way to describe it, they raise doubts about the reliability of the American currency, both as an instrument of payment in global trade and as a reserve asset. With Washington's economic and political decline, emerging powers are taking the multilateral approach. Russian and Chinese alliances with other countries have given rise to powerful groupings such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, which contributes about 30% of the global gross domestic product, or GDP, and also BRICS, which comprises 40% of the world's population, offering an alternative in international trade to the Bretton Woods institutions led by the United States. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is an international intergovernmental organization comprised of Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, while BRICS is an acronym for the current members of the group consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Following a recent BRICS summit in Cape Town, South Africa, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian pointed out that the five BRICS nations accounted for a fifth of the world's gross domestic product, one third of the world's territory, and 40% of its population, and embracing and forging cooperative relations with emerging powers would be critical for navigating the complex landscape of the 21st century. In this regard, the rise and decline of the United States offers valuable lessons to its allies and rivals alike, that unipolar world order is flawed from the start and doomed to fail due to its philosophy rooted in the Darwinian selective approach. The emerging order, on the other hand, calls for collaborative leadership, where nations come together as one collective entity with the objective to address today's problems. And these problems include wars, hunger, climate change, poverty, illiteracy, social economic gap, and terrorism.